So, two questions up that we've been discussing. First of all, I'll introduce myself. My name is Frank Simmerjee. I hate these podiums. I represent the Trustworthy Computing team within Microsoft. One of the recent changes that I've adopted is trying to create thought leadership in the space associated with reliability, availability, privacy, and security. Oh, you see, odds are going. More people come, odds go down that you're going to win the card, right? But we're not going to tell anybody new coming in. So those three pillars are pillars that I've recently adopted. I've been a security, long-time security gonk. I've done my share of security work. What's interesting is actually looking at it from a cloud perspective. So one of the first things I was kind of curious about is where do people place themselves at the end of the day when they think about process and compliance, security services, and identity? So since there's so many of you, I can actually kind of take a quick straw poll. How many of you think that you're on that upper end, that we've got this figured out, we've got the challenges taken care of on the completed or almost there side? Show of hands. I'm going to force you to answer. How about on the getting started and managing, ooh, 1, 2, space, making progress? All right, one hand there. It's just on the getting started, or you have no idea what I'm asking? No? Not too sure? Okay. So it turns out that based on roughly about 1,000 different organizations, most organizations fall into the two category. This is kind of United States-centric. Unfortunately, it shows that most organizations in the United States are the ones that are in that making progress space. One of the interesting things, though, that did come out is any of you in healthcare? You guys are further along. Did you know that? Yeah, you are actually. Your adoption of cloud services generally, or maybe in a hybrid mode or possibly a multi-tenant environment, I've got evidence, at least, we can say that we know a lot of customers. We have a definite indication that healthcare has made the most progress. So I'm really interested in knowing why, because I've been asking that question for a little while. What is it that's made the adoption? Is it HIPAA? I don't know. That's the answer I've gotten from most people, but I'm not 100% sold that that's the case. So what are the trends that I think every single one of you have faced? Obviously, consumerization of IT is one of them. Some of the things associated with, again, when you think about the security space, targeted attacks, identity and privacy, cloud computing, just in general, a sense, and availability of services. Now, I think that there's a lot of attention on availability. There's a lot of news that makes it into the public about availability. Targeted attacks has recently taken a little bit more of interest. I think that some of you are familiar with some of the targeted attacks that have been going on that certainly has inspired a lot of future writers, I think. And consumerization of IT. So at the end of the day, I represent Microsoft, but I know that every one of you probably face the problem of having more and more non-Microsoft technology, especially the very convenient handheld devices coming in to your corporate environment. The complexity of bringing that in, not only the risks associated with it, but just the difficulty of having those devices actually on your network becomes harder and harder all the time. So the big shift that we're seeing is both an opportunity and a risk. So I remember all of this. It doesn't feel like it's such a long time ago. And just a general shift that's occurred is, is this today? Is this tomorrow? Is this now? The reality is that data is getting bigger. I've seen several presentations on big data. I've done a session on big data because I get big data. Lots and lots of data. How do you actually manipulate and get information out of it. Now, of course, the security risks associated with that just kind of keep growing all the time. And at the end of the day, I think you guys will ultimately be responsible to manage that. So what's actually getting highlighted in the news? It's obviously the worst of the worst. At least it's the worst of the worst for that particular magazine or article. So we see outages associated with VMware going down, for instance. This was pretty big in May of 11. So how many of you have Sony devices and got affected by this? Yeah. You know, what's interesting is that you don't hear much about this anymore, do you? It's like yesterday's news. But if you were in the hot seat, and I noticed my timer never started. Oh, well. So if you were in a position of being a customer, I know I don't have a Sony device, but I'd really wonder today if I had to really think about that. Do I feel safer? Did Sony get this under control? Is my credit card floating out there if I had an account? It was cleverly just pushed under the rug. It just kind of disappeared. And then, you know, here's another one about confidential data, and I think that the list could go on and on. At the end of the day, I suspect that all of you are very well aware of all the different elements associated with the different news articles that get picked up. So the question that I try to think about and address is, what are the things that would help organizations better protect this environment? So if we look at the managing the risks at all the layers, there's no question that there's some benefits moving to the cloud, right? Especially in the hybrid state today that most of our organizations are dealing with, I think that there are certain elements of the stack here that a cloud environment would actually alleviate some of the work on your side, actually move it to potentially Microsoft. I mean, obviously, we have a pretty big cloud offering. And what I'm going to do is basically walk through all these different elements, and I'm especially interested in your feedback, again, since it's a pretty small group, on your opinion on host security and data, especially that's the transition between where most providers look after you in the cloud space versus something you have to look after. Because it doesn't matter what you expect your provider to do, if you don't look after your data, obviously, if you don't look after it, your provider is not going to look after the data itself. The container is one thing, the data is a different thing. So where are the responsibilities broken down, and can you actually address this? And this is certainly the message that I'm trying to convey with organizations so that their executives and management has a good insight on this. It's the, does the cloud provide the silver bullet and solve my problems? Just move it all into the cloud, right? It's all gone. Problem, poof, gone. The reality is it's not so simple. It's not so straightforward, and I have a feeling you understand that. But a lot of times, the folks that you have to talk to do not. Am I correct about that statement? At least I think, you know, talking to the C-level folks, they seem to certainly think that Microsoft will fix the problem. It just kind of goes away. So the stack here, I found that this was by far one of the best explanations I received when I saw this slide. I've been playing a little bit with it. But the concept is, where do the responsibilities lay? The line that splits the top half and the bottom half, notices, has a really big space on the customer. Because those elements do rely on you at the end of the day. And notice that you have more responsibility on the infrastructure side than you do, for instance, on a service. But what's the benefit of one over the other? In fact, again, after we're done with the session, I'd really be interested in knowing, besides what the obvious, what's the benefit of infrastructure as a service? So I'm supposed to be the super smart guy and know all this stuff, but I'll tell you, I still have a little bit of a hard time understanding why I would want to own everything from the network layer and up. I could see why I get rid of certain pieces, but those key elements, network and physical, is what your provider is going to help you out with. But you still own the identity, application, host, and data. I don't know that if that's such a good thing to own. There's a lot of stuff here now I have to maintain. I have to make sure that operating system is patched. The environment is running in a stable condition. It's my responsibility now. It's quite a bit of responsibility. I mean, there's benefit about elasticity, right? I can do this quickly. But is that good enough? Is that the reason to take on a potentially high-risk element like that? Moving on to platform, you see that it's kind of a split role. We end up with taking on that identity and access management. Here, the yellow band kind of covers it. I tried to do that halfway because I was kind of thinking that this really depends on the platform environment. Identity sometimes is co-managed, something that is managed between you and your provider, and different providers will provide different capabilities. Azure is a good example that it will actually give you this capability 100% if you want it, or they will actually take on some of these responsibilities themselves to some extent, right? I mean, at the end of the day, it's identity information associated with the accounts and things that you ultimately care about. I know at Microsoft, we've been given the opportunity with a lot of things to use our Live ID, not for our corporate access, but there's a lot of tie-in. And I wonder, with some of the issues associated with having something like, you know, federated service or a Live ID, is that such a really safe thing to do? I mean, I change my password pretty regularly, but I wonder how many people actually do change their passwords on a regular basis. And I have some information to show you about that. That is kind of a thing to take back because, again, real solid evidence that that's a problem. And then the software side, obviously we've moved up a little bit further. Your responsibility is still the host and data classification. Yeah, I'll ask about data classification in a minute here. Does this so far make sense? Is this a proper division? So physical security is a very expensive implementation. And I think that organizations tend to think all cloud providers are built equal and they're going to give you all of these fantastic things. Reality is that this is expensive, right? We're talking about facilities, fire suppression. It's a remarkably expensive process to install. I've managed data centers, small data centers. We're talking about, you know, the in-house. You raise a floor, put a fire suppression system in there, and you hope you never get trapped in there because it might kill you. Good news is I never had to witness that or figure out how that actually looks like. In a bigger facility, yeah, so I wonder if those fire suppression systems are still HALON. You're in a really big warehouse. Do you have enough time to get out? I don't know. I've never had to look after a really big facility, so I guess I'll never figure that one out. I guess it could be an interesting lawsuit.
Yeah, 4 seconds.
4 seconds, yeah. Yeah, and if you've seen some of these facility sizes, I mean, yeah, they're big. Now, one of the interesting things that I'm sure some of you are aware, Microsoft has actually taken on this whole concept of very modular data centers. They basically build them in trucks. They stack them. They become instantly available. It really makes a very elastic environment possible. Another thing, too, is when it comes to physical devices, the pizza boxes that Microsoft stacks and racks in our data centers, because of the volume of devices that we purchase, they are custom built. I mean, right down to the motherboard. Huge advantage. That means that every single unit is exactly the same as the other unit, which means that there's a really clean clean ability to be able to move from device to device, mirroring, all those things that you would normally have to deal with yourself. Microsoft does actually a pretty decent job. Multi-factor authentication and cameras. Next element associated with physical security is the distributed environment. So certainly another thing that is a risk that most organizations have to consider associated with where their data ends up. Microsoft spent quite a bit of effort and time coming up with policies associated with that, especially US-based data And there's a lot of different rules and regulations that you have to deal with is where is your data live? The advantage that I've seen is well-written contracts ensure that your data, if that's a concern, if you happen to work in an industry that's something you have to deal with, any federal agency, any agency, well, even if you're just paranoid, there are ways to ensure that the data is hosted within your continent. It's easy to say in Europe, you can also do the same thing, but Europe is many, right? It's not a country, it's many countries. So there are definitely associated elements. Microsoft has gone through quite extensive regs-based, regulation-based certifications. So ISO obviously is one. There's several other ones, especially some of the EU-based ones that are more recent. I'm not going to spend any time really talking about those. I'll bring it back a little bit, but they're so unique. The controls that are associated with it are things that I'm more interested in. I'm less interested in what regs are in place. So now we're moving down that stack. Now we're going to look at network controls and the network elements associated at the next layer. So one of the failures, too, that you also have to deal with, there's obviously the two sides of this, the expected and the unexpected. And this is something as you build out your data center or utilize a cloud provider, things that you need to consider. The expected ones are, again, ultimately, for instance, software or human error, it's going to happen. Millions of lines of code, there's a good chance that's going to happen. On the unexpected side, you really do need to have an environment where you have enough distance between your data replication model that you can actually prevent against it. There are exceptions. Obviously, when we look at criminal activity, for instance, if they're targeting you, that becomes a little bit more sophisticated. And if they're coming for you, the odds are that they have something, some bit of information about you that makes the attack unique. And I will state that when attacks are that sophisticated, usually the weakness is more of a physical weakness, less of a data weakness. You look at the attacks that have occurred to foreign nations, most of them have to do with that there was some process of intelligence gathering. If that's a concern to you, well, it should be a concern to all of us, but at the end of the day, it's a different scale of attack. And I don't honestly think that this is just happens to be, you know, Microsoft can be in the limelight for some of these attacks, but in reality is all products, all capabilities are subject to that type of attack. So design to withstand failure is a very important element that, again, Microsoft takes very seriously. This is, again, something that you should always consider when you look at cloud services. The whole premise of having all the pieces associated with your environment broken in a way so that you can actually have the ability to fail over. Most organizations, this is a very complex problem and requires a lot of specialty. So if you have a failure on any of your edge devices, a lot of times this is a telco level, right? It's something that you may not own. So it makes it even more complex. Now you're relying on somebody that's outside your organization to support you at a level that you require them to for you to be successful. More easy issues to deal with is if you have failures that occur within your data center. Obviously, recovery and restoration is something that you've probably already planned for. In my opinion, this tends to be the so-called easier thing to actually design for. Next item up on the stack is this whole concept of identity and especially all that consumerized devices coming into an organization. Now you're dealing with more and more third parties that are going to develop key components and capabilities within your organization for you to be successful. Most recent thing I've seen is iPads coming in to organizations and becoming condoned as the proper device in your organization. So, of course, you connect it up to your Exchange because you want your mail. And it turns out that any of you have iPads on your Exchange environment? Yeah? Change your password recently? Did you get your account locked out? Did you, your account lock out? No? You did something right. Because one of the most common things I hear is accounts get locked out, right? Or if like, there's a corporate policy change on password, expiration, you hit that expiration date, and the device locks out. It's very common and has very little to do with something. It's not an Exchange server or a connector issue anymore. Now you're dealing again with that third party that wrote a piece of code that's running on your device that has to ensure that it's going to try to connect up correctly. Now, one thing that they're not as familiar with, I can say that I've got some experience going back to the days of Mobile 6.1. I remember we had a very similar problem, and the fix was reduce how frequently the check occurs. Yeah, I'll give you a fix. So delay the time so that you don't have, you know, the checks as frequently. And one of the things is to ask the manufacturers to make sure that the return code's actually checked. You don't just keep pounding at it, right? So you're going to get an account lockout. Another thing, too, as an administrator, if you can't fix the code, you can always set rules on your Active Directory environment to... you're still going to want to lock out the account if it gets hit too many times, but maybe the question of how, the frequency or the speed, right? So if it's not occurring as quickly, the check for a bad password, you allow for more, maybe potentially a longer latency before it locks out. Those are not great fixes, but I mean ultimately things that you have to deal with. And you're going to see that occur more and more. More equipment comes into your organization, more devices that you have to deal with. You also introduce additional risk. So I don't know about you, but I've spent very little time looking at iTunes, right? And some of the attacks that I've seen more recently don't focus on the iPad. They potentially attack the client installation of iTunes, which gives you access to the device, which then gives you access to the corporate environment. I mean, as I said, it's the whole chain of events that you have to actually monitor to ensure that you actually protect your networks. But what we are seeing is better identity management over time, right? You're seeing a much, it's all about looking for that integrated identity services. There's a lot of partners on the floor that are working very hard and diligently to create these integrated solutions. One of the things that comes along with that for the ride is also the question of classification. Data classification is something that has historically been, I think, the thing that the auditor keeps asking for, and as the IT pro, you're like, I don't think I'm going to have to deal with that today. Because it's really hard to come up with a good model, right? I mean, how many of you here have a data classification model that's in place? Not enforced, but in place. Again, healthcare. See, you guys are cheating. You have no choice. So a couple of you. Now, the next step is actually enforcing that mechanism is another step, right? It's how do you actually enforce a data classification model? And then the last piece, which is, I think, even more frustrating, is how do you take that data classification model and move it into the cloud, right? How do you get your provider to actually ensure that the data classification model is actually something that you can actually manage, enforce, and control, not just in your environment, but across the world? All of a sudden, if you actually have a data classification system in place, things like data location become less relevant because obviously your rules that are associated with it would control and manage that issue. So on the host side, we see vulnerability disclosures are a good way to measure and get a better understanding of what's going on. Full disclosure is I used to own and kind of still own the security intelligence report, so if you're familiar with that, I have some copies here. It's too many people not to give them away. I have 10 copies, so it means they'll be maybe first come, first serve. Questions. I know. I'll give them away based on questions. They're really nice. They're these 10-year... It's the 10-year in review. So my job was to write this and come up with some analysis based on what's been occurring over the past 10 years when it comes to vulnerabilities, malware, pretty much everything associated with it. And one of the observations that's occurred is when you take a look at the severity and complexity of attacks, the good news is that medium complexity items have gone down, but low complexity attacks are staying persistent. What does that mean is that it's not a very complex attack to actually be able to potentially exploit these vulnerabilities. More importantly, though, is in the bottom left-hand corner there, we have app vulnerabilities are on the rise. They started out really big, they kind of dipped out, and they came back up. Notice that both operating system and browser vulnerabilities have stayed steady. That's bad news for, you know, manufacturers of these products and these capabilities, but the reality is the application space that most of the attacks occur. Why? Because it's easy. Everybody tries to work diligently to protect your browser, protect your operating system, and very little effort is placed into ensuring your applications are maintained and protected. This is boxed solutions. Now the question I have is, what about all the stuff that you write in-house? Spending the same level of diligence to protect it, and Christopher, did you bring cards along? So how many of you are familiar with software development lifecycle? Secure development lifecycle? A little bit? All right, I have some stuff for that in just a second here. All right, so here's the magic slide. I love this slide because it always tends to stump everybody. The purple line, notice that it starts out at zero, a little bump in 2007, and it's like a hockey stick. It really drives up really fast in late 2009, 10, and 11. Any clue as who that is? Whom? No. It's a vendor, by the way, so it's a little bit more. It's vendor space. Why do you think I'm going to beat up on Apple? By the way, this is CVE information. This came from NIST, so it's not like this was one of those Microsoft-created slides for Microsoft. This is actually public domain information. I heard Adobe. It's close, but not quite. All right.
Google.
Yeah, thank you. Google, they're on the rise. It's not good for us. I mean, not good for us as Microsoft either, because this shows that, again, the attackers know one thing that we should always think about is always the weakest link, right? You have to protect your whole ecosystem. So just because you're now installing the latest, greatest suite of Office tools because now you're glad you're getting away from Microsoft. Woohoo! Reality is that doesn't necessarily mean you're safer. Maybe it's cheaper. Doesn't necessarily mean it's safer. I'm not saying run out tomorrow and replace all your Google environment, but keep in mind that it's built on a common platform, and I think if you haven't taken a look at your Java installation recently, you should, because it's really good at patching your software, your current stuff. What happens to your legacy Java installations? Any clue how many installations of Java are running on your client's machines? One? How about two? Three? Maybe four? The current one's patched. What about the last three versions? So as a result, you see some of the other players that tend to unfortunately have relatively high hits. Enterprise Linux is really at the top. And I have to state that this has a lot to do with something that I've seen in personal experience, being a former coder that did some work in the open source community. One of the big problems that occurs with open source code is you get a job one day and your project just kind of, you know, just floats. A good friend of mine wrote, anybody use wget? Anybody know what wget is? It's a really cool little tool, right? I love that tool. A good friend of mine did the initial code, and then it was forked off of his effort, and then he got a job at Google, and yeah, he just kind of like pushed the code out. It's now open community, right? I mean, that's the way it's supported. I think I saw two or three vulns based on just some, you know, mistakes he made. He's not going to fix it because he's too busy doing his day job now. So where does that leave you with the environment, especially if you depend on something like wget? Because wget does something really cool. I mean, if you ever want to sponge down a website very quickly, it's effective in that capacity. Apple plays a pretty big role, and this is a primarily, most of the volumes occur in a module of the browser. So we're dealing with Safari here primarily, and this is one module and several vulnerabilities. Now, there are some mobile vulnerabilities, too, inside of this. So this is everything, if it was associated with Apple. Oracle, Java. Yeah, we're there, too. We had a history of plenty of vulnerabilities. But it's interesting to note that we may not be the best, also not the worst. Bottom line, one vulnerability is more than what you need to deal with, right? Millions of lines of code, odds are it's going to occur. And ironically, Adobe is actually down further, down the list. And they actually had a really good year last year. And then this year, I think they had some flash problems more recently. It doesn't help. I mean, that kind of stuff doesn't help. The question that I've received and heard of over the years working on this kind of information is, so how many signatures does it really take? How many variants of malware exist in the wild? Because everybody likes to count families, right? It's like, how many are there? I think that there was a time when you could have actually have done a count a long time ago. Today, it gets to the point where there's so many different elements that play into that effort, such as polymorphic behavior and different types of packers. I mean, most of the folks that write malware today use very common off-the-shelf packers, for instance. And just, you know, think of your zip file. Well, they zip their files too before they deliver it to you. They just use a custom edition of it. And that makes it difficult, not impossible, to do identification of what that piece of malware does, right? What family did it come from? Doesn't help that also a lot of these malware families only take one click to alter, because they create these really pretty little graphical interfaces that makes it really simple to use, right? It's like, click this, it's, I mean, it's an a la carte process. And then the really special button that says, you know, I want that latest bit of code that's gonna exploit, I don't know, Firefox and IE. Well, that'll cost you $5,000. And of course, malware writers have $5,000 ready to go. You know why? Because they stole credit cards already, so they already have that money. And one last thing is that something that, you know, at one time, you could have installed a piece of any malware software, one floppy disk, right, 1.44. Today, you're dealing with a stack, like 100 floppy disks, and even that's not enough. So you need to deal with capabilities that have products that have more real-time ability to maintain those signature bases. The MMPC, the Malware Protection Center within Microsoft, has actively moved to a much more cloud-centric. So you know when you enable MAP inside your Forefront tool, folks that are running MSC or Forefront, no? Wow, okay. Well, we do provide signatures just about real-time today. It's too slow to download that information. It has to be available much quicker. And Scott Wu, my colleague, did a demo about that actually Monday on how that occurs. If you're ever interested, it's actually really fascinating. You can read up a little bit about that. I'm not going to spend much time on that. But the whole concept of real-time detection and cloud-based, you know, the so-called big data-based detection. So what are the malware families? A little bit of insight as to what keeps the malware detection teams, like myself, inclusive, up at night. The types of attacks that are more and more common deal with attacks that focus on the user. It's one thing to try to attack your software. It's another thing to attack you. And let me ask you, here's a scenario I'm sure you've heard recently. You get a phone call from your aunt, uncle, brother, sister, saying, I'm on a pulpit here preaching. Hey, John, I got a little problem. This message popped up on my screen and it said that my computer's infected. And there was this button that said that if I wanted the advanced capabilities, click here. So I click there. And the software's really cheap. It was only $19.95. I thought it was a great deal. I bought it. What do you think? Well, what do you think? What are you going to say at that point? Anybody? No answers? Come on. What are you going to say? What are you going to say to that relative, uncle, friend, whatever? Yeah, change your credit card. Yeah, no, that's probably the right answer. I think what's even more clever is that these malware writers a lot of times will actually have a little checkbox at the bottom of after the install. It'll say, for lifetime protection, another $10 or $9.99, click here. Right? Lifetime support. Don't you love it? It's like, I'm curious to know what would happen is if they actually tried to provide you lifetime support. All right, I really don't care. So the prevalent forms of adware, now the difference when Microsoft categorizes malware versus adware, primarily adware means that the individuals writing the code, these pieces of code, have one thing that malware writers today don't. Money, which most of them do. More importantly, they have lawyers. So that means they can force their software to become more legitimate. Because they're not really taking everything, right? I think there's a fine line. How many of you would say that PII has a fine line between clearly theft and that's kind of questionable? So let's do it this way. Show of hands that credit card numbers are a form of theft. I mean, come on, credit card numbers? All right, what about a password? We're still at theft, right? Now let's say email address, username, first name, last name, right? So we start going down that scale as an organization. You have to declare, again, this comes back to that data classification, is at what point do you consider it theft? Well, these guys have a very clear distinction, and they'll actually take it to court saying that I only took cookies, first name, last name, email address. Turns out that Zwangy, the top left one, will also rewrite your host file and put themselves as your preferred browser. Is that theft? Especially if you clicked yes on the install process? I don't know. I mean, that's a question I have to you. Here we're going to kind of shift now to the more enterprise. So far we're really dealing with that host. Remember I said this is where the you as an individual organization still have to deal with this problem. Let's take a look. Zlob, which has been a historically, you know, it's a pretty bad piece of malware, came and went. Most computers in that first half of 2008, H representing half. Zlob went away, but in that second half of 2008, we saw Configure emerge. What a great piece of code. Not for you, I'm just saying as for the writer, right? Brilliant piece of code. From the perspective of what it did very well. It spread, right? Worms are very effective because they spread really fast. And once it starts spreading, it'll live on the machine for as long as it needs to, and it'll stay put, right? We'll come back to Configure because I think that there's some interesting stories associated with that. So let's turn this same thing a little bit on its side. And my suspicion is you guys care more about on the stuff on the domain join side, right? That's the piece that, at the end of the day, probably is something you're concerned about. Notice what the number one attack issue or piece of malware you guys are dealing with? Configure, right? How many of you have had to deal with a Configure outbreak in your organization? At least one, two, a couple of you. It's a pain having to reset all those passwords, isn't it? Or all those account lockouts? I mean, that's usually one of the most common things I hear is, yeah, everybody got account, you know, everybody had to deal with an account lockout. Well, it turns out when we started tracking Configure, we've seen a recent reemergence of it also. It's coming back. Again, good piece of code. It spreads. Worse yet, it spreads in enterprises. And that's a lot of time because it sits dormant on VMs, for instance. And when you turn that VM back on, maybe because you're curious what was, you know, what was on that VM, because it doesn't know any better, it starts spreading again. There's five variants of this. Even the old variants know how to spread. And that's because of how it spreads. Primary thing that it uses is credential-based. So I'll show you what I mean by credentials. And notice that pretty much everybody in the stack, all our different product lines, are susceptible to credential-based attacks. You know the credentials, you can attack it. Notice Windows 7 actually isn't subject to the exploit or the auto-run abuse, for instance. On the home user, there is a little bit of a flip that occurs as more and more people still leave their auto-run capabilities turned on, or they'll deliberately re-engage it. So, you know, all this effort that we've done is to disable it because it was a problem. Home users tend to be, again, these are your relatives, right? You'll get that pop-up saying, if you re-enable auto-run, your products will run faster or better or whatever the wording that they provide. The reality is that becomes an abuse element that's associated with this particular attack. But you don't see it on the home space as much. And here's why those credentials are so easy to attack. This is the short list from the Configure dictionary attack. What do you think? Any of your passwords up there? How about your relatives? I almost guarantee your relatives probably have at least one password. I was actually kind of surprised. Some of these I didn't expect, to be honest with you. I mean, obviously, we have the standard QWERTY across the top key, right? Everybody knows that these are QWERTY keyboards, and it's QWERTY. Admin. Now, why is this a problem more in the enterprise than the home user? Because most of your administrator accounts, especially the older ones, how about your database? You don't want to change it because the minute you change it, your legacy app potentially will break, right? So now here's the trade-off. Legacy app breaks or it's compromised. Not a great exchange that you have to deal with there. But as I mentioned, we've seen a reemergence of this. So there must be some benefit to the malware writers to bring this back from the crypt. Must mean it's working. So Rogue Security, this is again more on the home side. These attacks are the ones that you're dealing with for your family members, right? Fake Green, Fake Sysdev. These are the big prevalent families, and the observation that I ended up taking away from this is that the individuals that write this, you think that they work for marketing organizations. Because as one package becomes less effective, because they know when we start detecting it, another one pops up, right? They create a new variant. So if antivirus software, fake antivirus software, is not really as effective, maybe they shift on to defragmenting your hard drive, right? I'd even suspect that some of these vendors or some of these malware writers have enough money stolen to potentially put maybe ads on TV. What do you think? I don't know, maybe. Another thing that's become very interesting about the way these guys behave is that they write code that's very, they can localize, right? Remember, they have money, so what's the one benefit of when you have money? Well, you can do things. You're not going to write really hard code. That's too tough. Code's a pain to write, but you can do graphics. That's cheap, right? And you can localize. Language is a piece of cake. Well, turns out that one in the middle with a little house and comes from a particular package called OneScan. And it was really popular in Korea because it's localized in Korea. I mean, it became the number one piece of malware in Korea. That's how effective it was. Why? Because it was localized. And I'm not saying that Koreans are, you know, unable to detect the difference between a good thing and a bad thing. But there's kind of a built-in mentality of, if it's written in our language, most of these attacks are, you know, US-based, it's all English. But if they wrote it for us, it must be real, right? It must be a really good piece of software. The reality is that attackers follow socio and economic trends around the world, and they will very much so target those attacks to those particular issues going on. I predict, and I'd almost be willing to put money on it, that there is an event coming up here. How many months? The Olympics is 4 months away? 3 months away? Anybody? Next month. Oh, it's going to be a busy month for our malware writers, because you know they're going to be targeting it. Tickets, one. What else? Swag. Limited swag, that's another one. I mean, those are the attacks that you're going to start seeing in your corporations starting probably any week, right? Have you actually started seeing that yet? I'm curious to see if it's already happening. I guarantee it's going to happen. I'm just curious to see how quickly these guys, when the whole process starts. No answer means a good thing, I guess. So, cleanest network on the world. Anybody have an idea? Let's see, does it say on here? No, it doesn't. Good. What is the cleanest country on the planet right now? Anybody? Any guesses? I'll give the first one away. What's the right answer? Cleanest country on the planet. Close. Huh? Denmark? No. Close. Who said Finland? Correct. Telesonera is in Finland. They happen to be one of the organizations that I spoke to not so long ago. And one of the things that they said is, we want to be the cleanest place on the planet. We're really proud of it. And you know what? One of the things that they've implemented is this concept of health management of computers. It's one thing to block a computer that is connecting to the internet and is not protected. It's another thing when they start spewing traffic back out on the network, the outbound traffic. Now, I can't say all countries like the United States is really ever going to adopt this type of philosophy, but there's evidence that it works, right? This is a fantastic story of a nation state that's actually implemented a technology, and the single largest ISP has been adamant about this process, and they've done a really good job of it. So for those of you that are considering things like network access protection or something of the sort, Cisco offers something very similar. In my personal opinion, it works. You don't even have to do it on an inbound. You can do it on an outbound, right? It's about spewing out, less about spewing in. Computer's not managed. It's not maintained. All right, it's one thing. But when that thing starts actually broadcasting outbound, things like configure can be managed very quickly with that type of philosophy. And as I said, even Cisco does it right at the switch, which is really great. I mean, cut that device right off the network. Person gets really upset. They pick up the phone and they say, well, you cut me off and I'm totally okay and I don't know what you're... At that point, you just deal with the person, right? You have a really good opportunity to interact. That's what we'll say. It's a help desk opportunity. In fact, actually, most of the feedback I've received from organizations, because I did a module for network access protection a while back, organizations that have individuals, there's a couple of colleges and universities that have implemented network access protection, and students that would be kicked off the network or isolated, when they would be informed, because you can do self-help, that they were infected. It's interesting. The reaction isn't negative. Actually, reactions are usually very positive. Individuals that think that they're going to harm others tend to be actually very receptive to being moved into the, we'll fix you, and you got a problem, but it has to be solved. So that's not a bad thing. So this comes back to, this is kind of like the single closing slide that I use for the intelligence report. And since the timer hasn't been running, do we have an idea of what time we're at? No clue? That's not helping me. It's too early in the morning. See, 9:15, we have another half hour, is that it? 20 minutes? I don't know. All right, well, you know what? I'll just keep going until we get kicked out, right? Or until you guys want to get to the next session. That'll be a good sign. Oh, really? Okay. Don't run apps that, you know, you shouldn't. I mean, I left this up there. You guys can read this. I don't need to read this out to you. If you're ever interested in the details, you can spend some time. So, secure development lifecycle, and Christopher has how many decks? 15. Almost everybody can get one. These are really cool playing card-like decks. If you've, how many of you, actually, you know, before you hand those out, Christopher, do dev-related work? On the dev side, the dev folks should definitely get it, because this is for you, number one. And everybody else, if there's leftovers, we can give them away. Because if you develop software and you haven't done secure development exercises, the whole purpose behind this deck is next time you sit down in a meeting and you guys are brainstorming, trying to come up with that great idea for the next capability, that next tool, and you've done all your design work, you get to a point where you're like, hey, everything's great. That's when you pull the deck out. Pull one of the cards out. For the devs, hopefully you know what Stride is, because it's about threat modeling. That's the whole concept of what are the types of attacks I have to deal with, right? Denial of service attack. Well, this deck actually is a double-purpose deck. Adam Shostak that created it, you know, he wanted to help devs and make it possible, but he's got kind of a split personality, and one of the things he did is he built it against a standard set of cards, right? It's 52 cards in the deck. So that means when you get bored of threat modeling, you can start poker, and your management comes in, right? And you say, oh, no, we're just threat modeling. It's all legitimate. Right? Come on, that's pretty cool, I think. When's the last time you've been able to say, I'm really doing work, but I'm playing? All right, how about another tool that can really make a big difference on your client side? Again, another piece that we put out, this is, again, free, is the enhanced EMMIT, enhanced mitigation something. I don't even remember what the acronym. Mitigation Experience Toolkit, that's a, these acronyms, we are so good at that. So the principle is that you run this, again, as a app on a machine, especially those legacy environments. The real advantage of this is that legacy software can actually be protected utilizing some very basic capabilities like DEP and ASLR. EMMIT enables it, basically shims the app and enforces EMMIT and ASLR, which is memory randomization and access limitations. So utilizing this tool, you can actually move products into a much safer state. Good example here is on the left side. You see Windows XP running a particular piece of software, and since you guys are all my friends, I'm going to tell you that that's a Adobe product. It's a viewer product that's pretty common, and just by implementing EMMIT on top of it, take a look at the change of vulnerabilities that could actually be exploited on that environment. Pretty substantial, isn't it? That's a huge savings of protecting that machine. So again, defense in depth, protect the environment. You use something like this, you can actually protect your environment much more effectively. And it's free, so you're going to download it tomorrow or today, right? So now we're starting to move into that last area. Trustworthy computing does help a lot organizations to better understand your, you know, as I mentioned, security, privacy, reliability. Protecting your data is something where you ultimately are the ones responsible. I'm sure every single one of you has done risk management, so I won't linger in this space, but this is a problem space that you have to deal with as an organization. lot of times we think about, you know, the whole planet, say it, do it, prove it. Pretty simple principle. It's interesting how frequently testing doesn't occur, because testing is time-consuming, right? So how do you pick somebody that is relatively neutral in the market? One of the things that I've been spending a little bit more time on is working with the CSA, the Cloud Security Alliance. How many of you are members of the CSA, at least familiar with? If you're not, you should take a look. One of the things that CSA offers, which is actually really clever, is a program called STAR. And it's an assurance program built on the premise that, as most of you know, if you ask a service provider for what controls and behaviors are in place, you know, what is your audit policy? Most providers will say, well, if you give us some money, we'll give you an NDA, we'll give you a copy of that information, right? That can be a pain, especially when you're trying to evaluate multiple vendors in the market. STAR provides an open format of that. So one of the things that we've done is Azure, Office 365, and Dynamics has published copies of the registry. It's 100 controls. Each control is answered as openly as possible. And one of the hopes is that over time you're going to see more and more vendors, the ISPs, the providers, actually providing these documents. And you can actually weigh, let's see, I care more about this and, you know, higher risk issue, so I'm going to go with this particular provider. One ask I'll say is, again, being a champion that has to deal with this a lot, is I'd like to see more of the providers that we deal with on a daily basis provide their STAR registry. There's a lot of players out there that still haven't done it. And a lot of times the excuse is it's too time-consuming, or better yet, actually, I heard a provider say, we haven't done it because nobody's asking for it. So ask for it. Here's an example of some controls and associated with it, right? It's like the language is relatively, you know, audit-friendly. But there's some really interesting information that you can get out of it. You can see the Microsoft responses there. Let's see, what day is it today? I'll mention the fact that one of the exercises that I've just recently done, and I'll be releasing a paper, I'd say about next week, I think. Yeah, next week. It's a transparency document that looks at the benefits of utilizing this. So one of the things I did is I actually looked at the crossover between all of the controls and how our providers, mainly Dynamics, Azure, and 365, utilize these capabilities and why the benefit of something like the CCM, which is what you're looking at here, could help you as an organization. So that paper is coming out next week. And then in a little bit here, one of the things that I've been contemplating is the whole concept of what's missing is maturity. So as an organization, how would you judge a provider based on whether they're mature or immature? How would you then take your environment, your maturity, how would you overlap that? Is that something that since you're here, is that something you see as valuable? And maturity, is that something you're concerned about, both your provider and yourself? So if I gave you a tool that helped you kind of like auto-calculate that and provided a really cool report, would that be worthwhile? Well, if you're interested in that, I would need your email address, and what I'll do is as soon as that tool's available, you guys could be my dog fooders if you'd like, because that actually is being built right now, and I expect to have that out sometime in July, but I'm going to be releasing it very quietly. It's going to be hush-hush. And I definitely need people to say that they're interested in trying something like that. Very simple questionnaire process. I don't need auditors. Auditors, you know, they have all their magic that they deal with. I'm trying to talk to non-auditors. All right. So I'll leave this up. And now back to my original question. So I'm going to turn this off now.